Welcome to Schoolin' Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds, featuring prominent leaders, subject matter experts, and thought innovators with their perspectives on the current challenges facing K-12 education. I am your host, Larissa Napolitan, a former teacher, instructional coach, and a member of the Branching Minds team, here to lead conversations and to shine a light on phenomenal educators and those that are on a mission to transform our schools and the lives of students. Before I share the episode with you today, I have to tell you about our free virtual MTSS mini summit on June 3rd. Our theme this year is behavior at the core. We are focused on integrating behavior supports at every tier. You will walk away with practical strategies and tools for climate and attendance. So check out the show notes to save your seats. Now on to our episode. In early elementary classrooms, many of the struggles we label as maybe attention or behavior or even readiness issues are really signs that young learners are still building self-regulation and executive function skills. And so today I am joined by Mitch Weathers and Sarah Oberle, authors of Executive Functions for Every K-3 Classroom. And we're going to talk about why self-regulation matters so much in these early grades and how executive function shapes learning. And maybe even get to some practical strategies for teachers that they can use right away. Welcome to the podcast. Mitch, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to see you, Larissa. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah. Well, and it's so exciting because Mitch sent me this email and was like, I'm writing another book for early grades. And I was so excited about this. I'm always excited about this topic. And so it was really fun to bring someone who's still in a practitioner. And so still in the classroom, I think you can bring some really good insight, Sarah. So I'm excited to chat.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, Sarah, I'm going to point this to you because Mitch, you've kind of gone into about why you're excited about this executive function work. But Sarah, I would love for you to share a little bit about your background and even just how you got into this, how executive function got onto your radar as something super important that we should all know about.
Sure. I have been teaching first grade this is year 18. I'm about to wrap up. You know, definitely my colleagues and I started to notice as the years went on a lot less independence with our students, less problem solving skills, trouble with things that they didn't seem to have trouble with before, or previously that would be like the outlier. And now the outlier is the child who isn't having trouble paying attention or remembering things or, you know, walking across the room and in the span of time, forgetting what someone just told them. So while we're noticing that, I'm in school getting a doctorate and I'm studying science of learning, which is sort of the science of how we remember, how we pay attention. And so I was heavily studying working memory at the time, which is one of the three core executive functions. So there was some overlap there. In that time, I also met Mitch, who had already, you know, was coming out with the book on EFs for secondary. And I thought, you know, it was kind of worlds colliding. It was like, I'm learning about working memory. I understand that that's one of the players of EFs. And we're seeing this struggle in the classroom, not necessarily kids having problems understanding content, but having problems just being students. And so all things kind of came together. And I said, Mitch, we really need this for our grades, because it's getting harder and harder to orient their attention, maintain their attention, control some of those impulses. And like I said, it used to be a one or two off. And now we're just inundated with the constant interruptions or meltdowns for things that perhaps we wouldn't have seen before. So Mitch and I stayed in touch for a few years and then the time was right. And so we decided to write this. But I really felt like as a first grade teacher myself, after having learned a ton and done a lot of research on working memory and then went on to look into executive functions, I thought, this is really what we need. We're struggling to get our students to learn, not because they can't learn, but because they can't exhibit the behaviors that they need to learn. And so I thought that, you know, primary teachers should be privy to this and also recognize that primary teachers need their own content. Like they need to be addressed separately because our students and our contexts are so nuanced. And so we need someone who understands our world.
Yeah. Well, and I think that as, you know, elementary and secondary function very differently, like the school day looks different for each. And I think that, you know, having that context for
for younger grades is really important. And knowing that some of those EFs that you maybe dig into more in the upper grades are like the foundation is laid when they're in kindergarten through third grade. So first of all, I would love for, and I can toss this to either one of you, but I would love to talk a little bit about why that self-regulation is a big part, a big priority in these early grades, like learning how to be a self-regulated being, especially like when we're balancing all these academic pieces too.
I'll start, Sarah, and then you can jump in after. I think it, Larissa, it might be helpful to pause and just a quick defining of executive functions in terms of these two categories. So Sarah mentioned core executive functions, which are working memory, inhibition, and cognitive flexibility. That inhibition piece, when you talk about self-regulation, those some strong overlap there. And that's the focus of this book, this second book. We call it the Blue Book. And the White Book, the first book, is really higher order executive functions, which is planning, problem solving, reasoning. And the reason that the research outlines them or kind of categorizes them is it's really the biology. It's when they're emerging or developing in us. It's not just a kid thing or a student thing, right? It's this human thing. And it doesn't fully kind of, I don't want to use the word finalize, but into our mid to late 20s, where that process is starting. So when we look at the primary space in particular, and we think about self-regulation, it's really important to keep in mind that they're just now starting to come on board, these core EFs. And so it's really helpful. And I think that's one of the things this book does. I've been referring to it is it's like putting on a pair of executive functioning glasses and you just see everything differently. It's not something else to do. It's not more work for the teacher. And that's really important. But with those glasses, having age and grade level appropriate expectations about what students can do or assumptions about what they can do. And just the being equipped with the knowledge of what's going on with these core EFs in K-1-2-3, pre-K-1-3, can really help with that process. I'm going to let Sarah talk specifically about first grade and self-regulation because she has lots of stories she can share about why it's so important. But before I stop, it's just as important in ninth grade and fifth grade and 12th grade. We're seeing the same things in the upper grades as well.
Yeah, I think self-regulation you can think of as an outcome of the successful orchestration of executive functions. So when we think about the three core, as Mitch said, working memory, inhibition, and cognitive flexibility, it's our ability to kind of self-monitor, to resist our urges and temptations, you know, being able to pause before you yell out, being able to pause before you get up and go somewhere or do something. But it's also making sure that you're starting the task that you're supposed to be starting and making sure that you are continuing that task. And can you hold the information in mind that you need to maintain while you're thinking about the content of the task? And when I say task, that could be, you know, a content task, like an academic related task, or it could be something as simple as getting yourself unpacked in the morning. I mean, we see kids come in and they put their backpack down and they get lost. And, you know, they have a whole rich imagination going on, clearly that they're enthralled in, but they are simultaneously unaware of what's going on around them. The ability to sort of stay in the moment externally as well. But, you know, this is also really important for primary because this is when our students are building the academic foundation for everything to come. So we don't want them leaving us not knowing how to read. I mean, they need to become fluent readers for everything else that they're expected to do in the subsequent grades. We want them to be, you know, to become writers. We want them to be proficient with math. And so it is even more important, I would argue, Mitch, in our years that we get it right. And that when something is not going according to plan or as expected, that we have enough knowledge as professionals ourselves to think about where's the breakdown, what's going on behind the scenes. And yeah, it could be, you know, it could be a problem with understanding content, but it also could be a problem with you know, a student's ability to maintain and remember what they need to pay attention to in the moment. It could be that they are overloaded with directions. And so it's not that they don't understand the activity, it's that they cannot remember how to navigate it. So it really does equip us as teachers with, you know, as Mitch always calls them as lenses, but gives us more ability to problem solve and not necessarily diagnose, but to consider more than just, you know, they don't know how to read. Well, what's really going on?
Well, and oftentimes, kind of like I said, mentioned in the intro, is that we see sort of sometimes the manifestation of maybe the lack of these core functions, core executive functions come out in behavior or in falling behind in academics because they've gotten lost and they missed that one direction at the beginning and they're like, what's happening? You know, all of those kind of things. And so I do think that getting some of this right. And I think, you know, Mitch and I in a previous conversation, I think we talked about is that some of this is helping students learn how to do school. Like you mentioned before, that just how to function within a classroom or how to follow directions. When we talk about this, as far as in the K-3 classroom, what do you want most that for teachers to understand about how these skills shape the child's ability to learn, listen, and even focus?
That's a good question. We could both respond. I think it's worth noting real quick, Larissa, that, and I kind of like to try to define or tease out, you hear executive functions, which are interrelated cognitive processes. Like these are things happening in our brains. But you also hear at the same time, almost synonymous with executive functioning, skills, which are these behaviors that we hope to see. And one way to make sense of that is to think of the skills or the behaviors as brought to you by or manifesting from the cognitive processes. And in that sense, like, you know, with the core executive functions or higher order, but since we're talking about core, it's not necessarily like we know that you're not going to grow or increase a student's working memory. That's a biological baked in finite resource that we all have. The same thing with inhibition. Like just tell the student, you need to just inhibit. It's kind of like saying you need to pay attention. And it's like, okay, like for a 5-year-old, like what's that mean? How do I do that? I got all this going on. It's about creating capacity to allow for those executive functions to, I guess, emerge or take place with just more capacity for them to be performed. And then the behaviors, the self-regulation, like how Sarah said that, like it's kind of coming from these core EFs. But, and this is where cognitive load plays such an integral part to core executive functioning development, is that working memory capacity can really help with that inhibition and cognitive flexibility. But if I'm maxed out, if the cognitive load's too high, as Sarah mentioned, it, maybe it's too many directions at once or too much content, or I'm struggling with something at home, like there's something going on that I'm dealing with, well, it's going to diminish with those behaviors you'd hope to see, or the likelihood of them because of that capacity. Weigh in on that, Sarah. For first grade.
Yeah, I think what's really important for teachers to understand, like Mitch mentioned, we are not trying to teach. We are not trying to force our students to speed up their development. But what we do want educators to know is that there are things that we can do in the classroom in terms of instruction, in terms of the physical space, that will alleviate some of the pressure on our students' very fragile at this point executive functions. You know, to understand just how under construction their EFs really are means that you're going to be much more mindful when you are thinking about duration of content and amount of content that you're presenting at any one time. Understanding attention and how inhibition plays, you're going to be careful about how much visual and auditory stimulus you're putting in your classroom, you're allowing in your classroom, or where you're placing those things so that you're not actually making it harder for your students to pay attention. So what we want is our students to use whatever cognitive bandwidth they have on the actual learning. We don't want them to waste their cognitive resources on trying to ignore things that we didn't even realize were causing this, you know, waste of bandwidth for our students. So, you know, I may be telling in the middle of instruction, telling a really great story, trying to make a connection with my students. And what I don't realize is now they're all thinking about when Dr. Emily went to Disney, and I can't get them back to the word problem or to, you know, the map skills that we were teaching because, and here I thought I was doing something good by motivating them to pay attention, but now they're all distracted thinking about their, and the hands are like, one time I, and you know, they all want to share that. And so it's things like that, that when educators understand some of these things, they can just be more strategic about how they structure learning experiences, how they structure the physical environment, routines, to preserve the cognitive bandwidth of our students for the learning. So we're not wasting it on, you know, having them try to get along with peers, you know, in a tenuous situation, or try to remember too much at once, things like that.
It's so interesting that you like use that term cognitive bandwidth, because I think that that's, to me, that makes a lot of sense of like, you only have so, the student only has so much attention to give, especially I think young students, and maybe even whether you come in with like a higher expectation than is age appropriate or, you know, cognitive appropriate. I would love for you to talk a little bit more about how that cognitive bandwidth maybe changes. And Mitch, maybe you can kind of chime in from that early grade as they grow. Is there anything to remember for educators to think about when they think about cognitive bandwidth from an early age as they grow?
Yeah. When we talk about cognitive bandwidth, we're referring to working memory capacity, which is kind of the engine, the stuff of learning. And just think about it as a, for example, like in the upper grades, as kids are starting to get older, it's back to where, kind of where we started, like the natural development, the biology of the brain, what's happening as they're getting older, where it would be totally appropriate for me as a middle school teacher, or say, I'll stick to my own practice. I spent a little time in middle school, mostly ninth grade, to bring up a Disney reference that might highlight XYZ that we're teaching. And although I know it's probably likely that most of my students have gone to Disney, they most likely have the ability to just hold that thought inside to make the connection I made and focus on the learning that's happening. And it would be kind of the exception to the rule if a student just couldn't do that, right? And that happens too. But it wouldn't be, Sarah's told me story after story. My mom spent her career in second grade, and there's just some things you learn. Like, if I do that, I've just lost them, because now that's all they're thinking about. Or Sarah told a story about her and her daughters went and did this weekend or something. And now it's like, you have daughters, and how many? Like, they're just where it's gone. And so as we're, students are getting older and we're progressing through the grades, that's back to that kind of grade level or age appropriate expectations. Yet at the same time, Larissa, it's just as important to keep that bandwidth in mind. Like, most of my work with our previous conversations, looking at the first book, An Organized Binder, and whatnot in the, kind of the upper elementary secondary space, came from my reality that being here in Northern California, large comprehensive public Title I high school, most of my students were multi-language learners. And so their cognitive bandwidth, if I wasn't intentional in my instruction and my routines and my expectations, they're just having to translate everything they're reading and hearing while I'm teaching them biology. And it's always tugged on my kind of teacher heart. There's an equity issue there, because if you're in a heterogeneous classroom and you're sitting next to somebody for whom English is their primary language, they're not using any of that bandwidth to keep up. And ideally, they're focusing it on the things we're trying to learn. And so how do we make that fair for all learners? And that's back to Sarah's point, is like, how much of that bandwidth is being taken up maybe in the environment, right? That the thought of, you've heard the saying, a noisy classroom is a productive classroom. And I always like to say, it might be, it might not be. It might not be for all learners. Like, those are some of the things we got to lead with curiosity. Let's just look into that. Maybe my routines are ambiguous, even in ninth grade. I've seen that with any student. It's like, what am I supposed to be doing? I just left English, because now we have that reality, right? I'm going to 7 or 5 or 10 different classes every day with different routines, if any, and expectation and different content, different teachers, different students. So that bandwidth starts to get eaten up. And so I think, so although naturally, just developmentally, we can give multi-step directions and kind of expect you to go do a 5 or 10 minute activity, and for the most part, it's going to go okay. We still have to be cognizant of that bandwidth, because we want to protect it as much as possible for learning, which is why after this project, I've been saying over and over and over again, I think it would be really, really helpful for every secondary teacher and upper elementary, for that matter, to spend a day or just some time in a really gifted primary teacher's classroom, because it's all intentionality. Everything. Like Sarah sent me this little clip of how long it took to model how to put your chair up at the end of the day, where I would have said, put your chair up. And if you don't, I'm going to look at you cross until you go, oh yeah. Right. And that's ninth grade. Like, and then I'm kind of done teaching that routine, where this was like a 5 minute multi-step process just to model it before they even practiced it. And so if we can have that, even in the upper grades, again, even though that bandwidth is kind of there, the more we can protect it, the better.
I mean, it goes back to, there's some just core things I'm remembering of like when I first started teaching, of just how important those routines were. Sarah, I'd love for you to kind of give a little insight of like, what is this? I mean, if a teacher's or an educator is listening to this and going, okay, well, I get this. This makes sense to me. Where do I start with this? What could they start examining or thinking about what it looks like to support that, some of those core things?
So absolutely. I did want to mention, in terms of our students' cognitive potential, there's really no hard and fast, like by this age, this much, because what we have to also keep in mind is that our own potential varies depending on how hard the task is, depending on what kind of stress we're under in that environment, or what kind of internal stress we're managing. Maybe we didn't sleep well. And we know this as adults. Different days, we are able to handle things differently. And, you know, right now I might be able to put a piece of furniture together, no problem. But catch me when I haven't had much sleep and, you know, maybe the directions are vague and it's a very different set of circumstances for me. So it's the same thing for our students. They ebb and flow just like us. And cognitive maturation is such a variable development as well. Being in your own classroom, the easiest thing to do to start is to look around your classroom and locate the places where your students have to pay attention. So, you know, for me, I teach a lot from the carpet. So my students are sitting on the carpet, I'm sitting in front of them. And what I want to do is look and see, are there things in that space where I want them to be paying attention that are also going to be competing with me, so that they want to pay attention to? And I need to modify. So it doesn't mean I need to get rid of things, but it means I need to think more strategically about where I put them somewhere else. Because, you know, it's like telling someone to eat more healthy and giving them carrots, but then also putting a donut right next to it. Like, you're making it harder for them. And we don't intend to do that, particularly in primary, where we're so proud of how warm and inviting our classrooms can be. The other thing, physical space-wise, and Mitch had alluded to this earlier, is when we want our students to talk to each other and, you know, develop their dialogue skills and collaborate, then talk away. When we are transitioning between things and, you know, maybe you have a song for cleaning up or a song for coming to the carpet, great. When you want your students to be thinking hard, anything else, talking, songs with words, noise, you know, talking from the hallway is a distraction, because we are drawn to language as a species. And so in a moment where you want your students to be working really hard and where they're, you know, firing at all engines, you want to eliminate as much language as you can around you. So that includes, you know, the kids that are chit-chatting. That includes, you don't want to have music with words on at that point. So those are really concrete things you can think about. The next thing I would do would be to look for places of ambiguity in the room. Look for moments of distress, in terms of, you notice that kids are, there's conflict coming up in some way, or there's big inefficiencies. And then think about, well, I probably either haven't been explicit about this, or there needs to be some kind of routine set. And as teachers, sometimes that means you don't even know, well, what do I want that to look like? I don't know. And that's where a lot of our trial and error comes in, and experience, and talking with your colleagues. You know, I decided years ago, when my kids line up, they're going to have a number, and that's where they always stand on the line until I change it, because eliminates the arguing, the she gone, she stood, you know, here and all of that. Just take it away. So when they are lining up, it's less of a problem. Mitch, oh, love, this is one of Mitch's favorites, but the glue stick caps and marker caps, we have lots of issues with those things drying out. So I have a whole thing in the beginning of the year, and we touch base on it when we need to, that we sit down and when we put the cap on, we listen for it to snap because we want to make sure that it's closed all the way. And that was because I noticed that this was a problem. Now, this isn't specific to learning, but it goes along with having, you know, efficiency in your classroom. And so finding the pain points and also, you know, just figuring out where you can within your instruction or when it's independent activity time, where can you alleviate some of the demand on working memory, or where can you alleviate some of the demand on your students' need to inhibit distraction? So whether that's allowing them to, you know, turn their chair away to the corner or put up a divider so that they feel less tempted to kind of look around, whether that's having them put materials away until the moment that they're going to use them, because then they're not tempted to be touching and writing and playing and going ahead and answering things in a way that you're like, I didn't say to do that, and now you have to erase it all. So it really is the knowing is what will spark, like, that's going to be a distraction, so we're going to remove that. Or that's going to waste working memory, so I'm going to have them do that now so that later when I really want them to use their working memory on demonstrating what they know, that piece is already done.
And all of that makes so much sense as you talk about it, right? Eliminating things that pull them away from the task at hand. And I'm sure that as you've taught over many, many years, you have an understanding of this is how this age group's brain works, or like what some of those distractions are. Is there something that you find that is surprising and that you've had to, we need to practice this? Or what's something that you feel like is been part of this work that you feel was surprising that you didn't anticipate, or but makes that kind of falls into some of the you know, working memory or, you know, other executive function things?
There's a lot of things that I could share probably. And to your point about, you know, years of experience, a lot of us do figure many of these things out through the years by trial and error. We don't necessarily know why it works or what to call it or what we're protecting, what we're offloading, but we've figure out, okay, this isn't working. Let me try something else. Mitch and I would like our novice teachers to have this information from the get-go and to have a shared language around it to say, I'm going to, you know, that's going to be too much demand on working memory, et cetera. For me personally, content related, I will say I had a lot of ahas because some of the things that I thought were peculiar as the years went on, students who are learning to read, and then, you know, I would watch them decode or I would watch them struggle through a sentence and then realize that they cannot recall anything, including being able to blend sounds in the correct order, because it was so much work for them to segment that word or to get that, you know, word, to segment the word, to write it or to get the sentence down, that they are maxed now. So for me to ask them, okay, what does that mean? Or what does that say? And they're exasperated. And it happens over and over. Or they'll, you know, they'll segment a word and then they go to blend it and it's something totally off the wall. And you're like, huh? And after, you know, noticing that for a while, I was like, it's the working memory. They don't have individual sounds fluent enough to where their working memory is just working on the blending. Working memory is holding the sound, trying to remember the sounds, pull them out from long-term memory if they're there, hang on to them, keep them in the right order, and then blend them together to make an actual word. And it's too much. So, you know, the power of automaticity of prerequisite skills, the foundational skills. If you're working on, you know, decoding, make sure that they're fluent in letter sounds, right? If you're working on equations, make sure that they know what those numbers are. Some kids are still like, is that a five? I'm not sure. So the more that we can remove from working memory because it's automatic, because anything in our long-term memory that's stored there and is stuck there does sidesteps working memory. So it's kind of like a little sigh of relief for working memory that I already know this. If I ask you what's 4 plus 4, you're not tapping into working memory. You're not analyzing anything. You just know it. You use zero cognitive bandwidth to figure that out. So when our kids can have those basics, where they know them, I'll say like in a snap, you know it in a snap, you don't have to think about it. Then they're ready to move on to using those pieces to learn harder skills, more advanced things. What we don't want is to say, go write a sentence when they're not fluent with letter sounds, they're not fluent with letter orientation, because now the job that you gave them is so much more than just write a sentence. It's, you know, figure out the mechanics of the sentence, figure out the sounds in the word, figure out which letters make those sounds, figure out which way the letter goes. So, you know, I have, through my own practice and in learning about this, besides just the stuff that I tripped over after, you know, years and years, really understanding that when you peel back what you're asking your students to do, there can be a lot more expectation there than what you think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I co-wrote a literacy guide, and now I want to like rewrite it. because it makes so much sense, that idea of like when you max out that working memory, or even just like they're done, right? And I would say this with any kind of executive function, like core pieces of it, it's like when you max out that piece, like I think I don't know if this is true, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming like when there are some kids, when they max out their ability to inhibit, like where they max that out and they're like done, to they're not able to do that.
Yeah. I mean, that's 100%. Called a meltdown. That's called giving up. That's called, you know, behavior issues. And as adults, we have those moments too, where we're worried about something, somebody cuts us off, something else, drop something, spill something, and then all of a sudden, you know, we've reached our limit and snap at the next person that talks to us, or we do something that is indicative of our own loss of self-regulation in the moment. So absolutely. And our kids have so much less potential than us as adults, and are full grown, and they're still, you know, they're really in the midst of just developing these things. So it can take on a lot of forms. And we do want to emphasize, and we do in the book, that, you know, some of these things, yeah, maybe you have a kid that just wants to be a little defiant in the moment, but maybe mentally maxed out and has reached a breaking point, and you're seeing it manifest as behavior or giving up or shutting down, withdrawing. Everybody has their limits.
Well, and I think when you think about younger students, if they're in school all day, right, like it's probably why you don't put those core subjects at the end of the day, because you know that they're going to be done. So, I mean, even just like, I think that's just good to kind of think about those things as a part of some of the development of these skills, or even these like building that capacity. Is there anything else that you feel, and this could go to both of you, but what are some things that you think that part of, and there's a lot of leaders, educational leaders that listen to this podcast too. What is something that maybe they should consider when they think about building those executive functions within the classroom or for students?
When we consider executive functions, and we're talking about primary classes this time, but in our previous conversations, so we're talking about bigger kids, what we keep coming back to, if you stop and kind of zoom out, is environment. It all can be under this kind of an umbrella of can we more intentionally shape learning environments that lead to better executive functioning? That's really what we're talking about. And one interesting way to think about that as a school leader or a district leader, it's just a larger environment. So that's an interesting conversation around, let's just keep it at the elementary level. What is shaping the environment in ways that leads to better executive functioning look like in the hall and on the playground and the cafeteria, and recognizing that they're just different learning spaces. There's still learning going on, but it's not in the classroom. But my favorite, I think, conversation to have is, you know, everything we're saying as well is grade level and like content area, subject area agnostic, because we're talking about one, human development and capacity for learning, enabled self-regulation, like the subtitle for the book, Self-Regulation for a Strong Start, what this is all about. And whenever we can bring something that has this kind of impact to a school or a district that's grade level and subject area agnostic, then we can get collective about it. This is a conversation that a first grade team could have with the second grade team and the third grade team. What I realized is that if you don't spend time in those grade levels, those grade bands, you don't understand that like what's happening in first grade isn't just different than what's happening in third grade. It's like a quantum leap. It's like, if we're going to talk about subject area and some things, the conversation may start to break down. But when we have something, again, that's agnostic, but has this much of an impact, it starts to be a really interesting conversation because it is developmental or sequential. And when we get collective, everybody knows this, collective efficacy has like the largest effect size most of the time. And so when we look at school leadership and district leadership, it's these conversations that it can really have a significant impact. And we're not talking at all about the specific things we're learning, right? Outside of some of what Sarah's saying with like learning my letters, words, and sentences, and learning to read. But the kind of the curriculum, I guess what I'm saying is it's agnostic to all that. And I find that conversation fascinating. So that's what I would say to leaders. What about you, Sarah?
I'm going to be really specific here and speak as a classroom teacher. I think that there is from administrators and it's coming down to them from probably the state level or SEA level, LEA level, that they should be doing walkthroughs and seeing rooms that have, you know, standards posted and have, you know, all the vocabulary words from this entire unit posted and make sure you have your map up and everybody should be talking. And I think we need to think a little bit more scientifically sometimes and think about when you are studying, when you have to think really hard, do you want to sit around a bunch of people that are talking and being loud, or do you need quiet to concentrate? So I think respecting our students' cognitive needs is important. And I think visually, there can be things that we are told that we need to have hanging up. What's the purpose, right? Is it to check something off that, okay, we know the teacher's doing this because this and this and this is hanging up? Okay, well, what does that mean for our students? Is it static? Is it going to be there all year long and they'll habituate to it so they're not even going to notice it? Or is it something that's always changing and now we've just added something else that is competing for their visual attention?
I mean, I love that you called that out, right? Because it is really, there's these pressures of you have to have your objective and you have to have your standard posted and all these things. And I think it's important for leaders to think about what are they asking of teachers to do with intentionality? Like, is this, what's the purpose behind this?
Mm-hmm.
And thinking of like appropriateness for grade level, right? Because maybe that's, you know, in a sixth grade classroom, kids aren't going to pay attention to that anyways. It's fine. And to me, I would hope that leaders are looking at when they're doing those walkthroughs, thinking through, I can't always see the learning that's happening. Sometimes it's happening in ways that we don't necessarily see. I even just think to having this idea of how environment impacts learning and how just even that the small intentional choices are important for students.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things I really want to ask you guys. But I think the last question I'm going to ask is just, what do you hope that this book provides for educators? What is maybe one thing that you're thinking about? I hope that they read this and walk away with this kind of insight.
For me, it's I hope that educators feel seen and feel understood and valued, that yes, what you do, your students, your work is different than, you know, and should be treated as such. That teachers feel like finally someone is talking about this aspect of teaching and learning that people don't usually talk about. It's usually everything we mm-hmm. get is content related or it's more social emotional. That's getting a lot of attention, but no one really talks about how do we protect and promote our students' actual thinking and learning. So I hope that primary teachers feel valued, seen, and that they feel empowered, that they can professionalize their decision making and their planning in the classroom.
For me, Larissa, it's the question you had asked, Sarah, like, where do you start? I don't mean this to sound self-promoting for Sarah and I. My hope is that they like that relief, like, oh, this book is where I start. And my hunch is from feedback we've already received is it's probably one of those that is going to sit on the primary teacher's desk as like a quick reference at times. I've had like, and I'm not exaggerating, 30-year plus veterans who've read it that are, one's coming to mind right now, a kindergarten teacher in the two or three times that I've seen and chatted with him, he spent a big chunk of his career in kinder and then moved on to, he was a principal of an elementary school, K-6, and then has left that in the last 2 years. He's gone back to the kindergarten classroom. And he picked up the book, you know, you kind of think like this guy knows everything. And he's just like game changer for me. Some of like, it, like that. Now I understand what that, why that's happening. And because Sarah and I are both practitioners, he didn't have to like extrapolate. It's like, I'm going to try that strategy that is a simple thing with a whiteboard that we talk about in the book. And he's literally like, oh my gosh, transformational in my classroom. Like, and it's back to that protecting the capacity. So I hope it's, I'll echo Sarah that primary teachers, and I really want to keep plugging this secondary people, please read this. There's so much in there for all of us, but that primary teachers really feel seen and heard. But just that, yeah, like this is the starting place. I have a place to try to understand executive functions, the science of learning, all of it in that way and in a very practitioner friendly sense. So that's my hope for it.
I mean, this is a whole other podcast conversation, but I think even just that need for educators to really understand the science of learning. Like, I just don't think that's talked about enough within, it wasn't in my teacher prep programs, like just that idea of how students learn or even how we learn things and like what happens in our brain. Like, I just feel like there needs to be more of that, because I think when you do understand that, it impacts so much of how you structure the process that you go about within your classroom. I think if I had known that, there's so many things I would have done differently. There's a lot less I would have tripped over I love that you mentioned that, Sarah, like tripped over this I think that that's really true. So
Say that right at the beginning, like the whole, like one of the intentions of this book is that you don't have to trial and error it for 3, 5, 6, 7, 8. Like why are we doing that when we know?
Yeah. Why are we gatekeeping these things?
The knowledge that, you know, it's the physician who's not allowed to study anatomy and physiology when they're like, what we do. I mean, it's all boils down to these messy human to human relationships and interactions, but it's all about learning, which is the brain. So, and it's interesting, right? As a teacher, you're like, oh, that's really interesting. That behavior, like, so
that's all in there. Well, thank you so much for this conversation. I'm so excited to share this book. I'll share the links in the show notes so that everyone knows how to get a hold of it. And if you didn't know this already, Mitch, I think we included you a part of a book giveaway. And so this book will be on our list that I'll share. I usually share a summer reading list for educators. And so I'm excited to share that with our followers and our community as well. So
cool. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Larissa.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Schoolin' Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds. Go ahead and subscribe to our feed wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget, if you are enjoying our content, would you do us a favor and rate and review our podcast on iTunes? This helps others find our podcast and lets us know how much you love what we're creating. Branching Minds is an educational technology company using learning sciences and technology to help districts effectively personalize learning through MTSS. To learn more about us, check out our website, branchingminds.com, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn @branchingminds.